even if we think we are in control, are we really? I think that's why death is so frightening to people, and they won't talk about it ordinarily, because it's a symbol of what's to come, but we have absolutely no say in it. We just don't know. Other things in life, even our health, try as we might, it's not really, we can manage it, but we can't stop karma from unfolding or playing out. When I was a young woman, before I became a nun, I studied nutrition. And in particular, I studied malnutrition, which is the lack of nutrition, or unsatisfying, unproductive nutrition, eating the wrong food, mostly, or not having enough. So I worked in villages in Thailand and in poor, underdeveloped countries, like also in Ecuador, Nepal. And I saw the most horrific scenes of children. I worked with malnourished children, measuring them up. We used to go out to the poorest areas and ask the locals, where is the family with the least food? And they would point to a house, and we would go and meet the people in that house and ask if we could measure their children. We had these scales, so we would weigh the kids, and of course immediately we had our formula to measure and see how badly malnourished they were. And then in a couple of particular projects, we did these programs to not just take care of the children, but to educate their mothers, because they didn't understand, first of all, about clean water. So there was a lot of poor health in the kids because of infection. And they didn't understand about nutrition. So you'd see these skeletal babies. But the mothers didn't love the children any less. There's one particular image that comes to mind where we went to the house of a family and the woman had 10 children. And in that particular project, we were doing a combined nutrition and birth control project. So the women were asked to get help with birth control. This woman, we came a bit late. She had 10 kids. And she had just had twins, I think. At least, well, they were very, very little. So, yeah, I love kids. And the woman was very happy to meet us, and she wanted to show me her new baby. So she ran in the house and brought it out and handed it to me. This child was just a bag of bones. It was actually quite a horrific feeling to hold this poor kid that was barely a child, was barely alive. And she loved this child, you could see. It's not that it wasn't lovable, but it looked like an old man. It really, like an old human being. It had that face that was completely deformed. And so my reaction to holding this child was horror. I was horrified. But I saw her face and it made me reflect. Her love was boundless. It didn't, of course, she didn't know how to take care of this child. And she had no money to get food. The husband had sold their last buffalo, and there was no, he had no money. They had no food. So, of course, we enrolled them in the program, but it was too late for the new baby. and it died. But I think what I take away from that memory is how boundless love can be, that it doesn't matter the state of the human, but the love remains untouched by that. Because when we are connecting to an unconditional love, the object of our love, whether to others it's not beautiful, to you it's still beloved. And it brought up a lot of compassion in my heart. And it also helped me lean more and more towards the Buddha's teaching about compassion, because I was dedicating my life to helping people in dire circumstances, but I couldn't really help them. I couldn't give her food. I couldn't give her an income, because our program was about food. It was about education. And then I realized the government wasn't doing the right thing. They just wanted to sterilize all the women, which would have a very strange effect on the community in the goodness of time, and also on the mental health of these families. Because I watched this process, and it was brutal, not compassionate, and inhuman, I felt. So after that, I doubted the work I was doing. And I was still really interested in nutrition. And then I understood that what we really have to develop is spiritual nutrition. And that's what led me to become a nun. Because I felt if I could also develop my own spiritual understanding, then I might be able to help bring a nutritional element to women in particular, but because as a nun, that's kind of how I thought it would be. But when you're in society, it's to everyone. But then you cannot change the leadership of society. That is still a kind of a brick that you can't move. So whether humans are getting enough real food or spiritual food, a lot of the systems that allow food to be provided in both cases is the leadership, social leadership, the economic leadership, and the moral leadership. And I see that now, as society becomes more digitally anonymous, you can do terrible things without being punished. Because if you go on the internet, you can be anonymous. And this must be the worst scourge on the moral well-being of humanity. On the other hand, the most good can be done with these technological advances by spreading the Dhamma more and more to people who would not have access. And so always there's the understanding within of what might work better, but then there's the world and the tricks of the world and all the egos that control worldly winds and currents. And then there's always an element of beings that want to turn the tide of that system. And I think that's what we're trying to do here. That's what we're trying to do within us, is turn the tide away from following the currents of the world and living through the moral well-being of the heart, of our thoughts, of our actions and speech, But the root is, of course, the body has to be well. We have to eat well. Not too much, not too little. The right kind of food. Don't have chocolate for breakfast. Even if you have no appetite, but sugar is always there. It's not the best thing. And the same is true in the Dhamma. This might be a raw point, but I'm going to go for it. So what looks good may not be good. So it might look good to go on retreats and be on retreat and always go away from the world and have the quiet, the silence, the non-disturbance of the world and have beautiful mind states. But it's not enough. We have to use the right means to develop that moral verve in the heart. And that would come not by running away from the world, and it isn't running away, but because it's so legitimate, but it's finding ways to practice Dhamma where there's no disturbance, the conditions are really good, you can listen to a Dhamma talk on a Zoom, you don't have to show up in person, you don't have to go anywhere, there's no effort, and then when the talk's finished, you can go have drinks with your friends, and sometimes they're your Dhamma friends, but not really the prescription for restraint, letting go, following the precepts, and taking care of the mind. Taking care of the mind. So that's up to us. The government can do what it wants. People can dislike us being here. They can be critical when they see us standing in the market with our bowls. But in fact, a lot of people over the years get to like it. And I have to share this one little cute and unusual circumstance. So we're standing dressed in these unusual robes with a bowl, which people understand the bowl. They think we're begging for money. People come and want to put money in. Sometimes it's a $20 bill, it's not coins. No, no, cannot. Oh, they don't get it because the bottom line, the currency, is money. But the moral currency is love. The moral currency is kindness. There's one man in the market who has a vegetable stall, and he always walks over. He doesn't have a clue what we're doing there. But we had a little interaction with him, very friendly. And ever since then, he comes with an offering. So he brought us some radishes, put them in the bag, because the bowl, you know, it didn't fit. So we keep a bag there for the big things. He put it in the bag, and then we stood there the rest of the time. And just towards the end, he comes up, he has this bunch of beads in his hand. And he says, "I got a customer that needs radishes. Can I trade you?" It was just so heartwarming. And we took out the radishes because we didn't want him to miss a sale. But the way he asked was so loving. There was no greed. It was just a practical matter. He doesn't make a lot of money. He's a farmer. A very humble stall with some veggies, a few flowers. So the currency of kindness is so powerful. It's really beyond what we can imagine if we just trust it. We stand there, we come back with bags of food which can feed all of us. This was just yesterday. And a lot of it is from strangers. When they first come up to us, is with money, because they don't know. And then we explain it. Oh, they go away and come back. Can you eat this? And will you have this? There's lots of wonderful stories. But the main thing is the understanding that we're not following the currency of money, and they don't really understand that, but they appreciate it at a deep level. And then food, which is exactly where I began my journey with nutrition in the food department. I find it so ironic that people are now giving me food for all these years after I was so involved with giving food to kids and women, poor families. They didn't beg. They were just very poor and malnourished. I wanted to talk a bit about the malnutrition of the mind. So, going on retreat or listening to Dhamma talks and then engaging perhaps in behavior that isn't on the same level spiritually as a meditation retreat. Because living in the world, we have to face those currents and deal with them. But when we're practicing in the stillness of our own room or vihara or a retreat center, to notice that when the mind is held as a precious presence, not something to be silenced, there's no aggression. There's more of a bearing witness. We might follow a technique and try to beat the mind into submissiveness, like, gotta sit still, you gotta be quiet, gotta get this right. Then we have that kind of achievement motive to get, to do, to succeed. And the letting go, the renunciation factor, the right effort is out of balance. And it's a bit like a recipe for good food. Because if you eat only one kind of food, like I've seen kwashiorkor babies, they have the wrong kind of food. They don't have enough calories, and so they die very quickly. But a malnourished child can live for a long time, especially if they get some kind of nutritional input over time. But the kids that are not getting much at all, or the wrong kind of food, they die quickly. So it's the same with the practice. If we can be content with the present moment without trying to beat it into some kind of formula or form or project with an ego behind it, looking for the achievement of a goal, then we really give it the right food. It's balanced food. It's a food that will help the mind naturally to go to its own depth, to its own inner stillness. We don't have to sit on it and squash it and fight with it. No matter what kind of mind states might be going through, if we just sit with them and measure them and know them as anicca, impermanent, hurts, dukkha, no one there. Who is that that's there? We need to find out. This is what the spiritual emergency is about. It's to come out of what we think we're seeing. It's to come out from our conditioning, to emerge and see. It's an emergency to see correctly without all our conditioning, without all our opinions and the programming that we've received about This is how it should be done. Don't do it like that. Just allow the mind to be in its own nature, just as it is. Just be with that and make peace with whatever is arising. Then when we go back into the world, we just follow the current of kindness, of love. If we sit with this formation, just developing that sense of gratitude and loving kindness for having this body, having enough health that we can practice and be here and do the work we have to do, or not work, but even being a human being is a lot of work. And especially when you have ants infesting your kuti, and you try to pick them up one by one and not harm them, catch them in a yogurt container and take them for a long walk, because they come right back. They're so smart. They know where the water is. So the currents of the world are just like that. It's like a horde of ants come crawling back and take over the mind. So the attitude of gratitude, the attitude of accepting conditions without trying to enforce change, but to witness the desire, witness the impatience, witness the fear, witness the unhappiness, then these things automatically change, because that's the nature of whatever arises in the body or the mind. So the healthy mind is one that is made healthy through awareness and through that unconditional loving kindness and realization that this body and this mind is the perfect vehicle for waking up. And waking up can happen in the bathroom. Baba, my root teacher, where he really planted the root of my spiritual waking up to the reality of what we are, and he told me, you must practice even if you're in the bathroom. And when he first told me that, I was so shocked. What? Well, okay, I trusted a lot. And so next time I went out with my little, when you go in India, you take a lota to wash your hands and go to the bathroom, squatting in a field and squatting there and trying to be aware. Just not lose the plot, but just be aware. Where's my lota? And I realized how hard it was. And I understood that in these simple little tasks of life, where we have as much need for awareness as in the times when we're in normal activity, we need to keep that continuous flow. So when we leave here and go back to our familiar surroundings, to bring up that sense of pure presence, knowing things just as they are, with whatever mind state comes up, and let the Dhamma flow in. Let that economy and that loving factor, that, you know, this is the basis of our life. This is the spiritual nutrition that we can offer ourselves even as we fall asleep. And then we can be mindful of what we dream. We may not have such a nice dream, but it doesn't matter. It's a dream. Well, this whole life is just a dream. It starts, it lasts for a while, and it ends. And if we weren't mindful when we were born, but we did call out, ah, because we woke up to being born, right? Birth. So our spiritual birth will be a death. We can be mindful, and we will also call out, oh, ah, ah.